How to make your life count for Christ. Well, this is really challenging. Let me start off by saying, the choices you are making right now will pretty much determine the kind of person you're going to be when you're my age. I'll be 34 next week. And men and women, let me tell you, you do not have the luxury of simply waking up one day when you're 34 and waving a magic wand over your life and all of a sudden making it all be exactly what you want it to be. No, it will be what you have been investing in it being all those years. Now, that's not to say God cannot intervene in His grace in anybody's life and change them. Thank God He can. But it is to say He does not wipe out the past either. Therefore, the choices you are making right now will have a great lot to determine with what you're like in the future. So if you want to alter your future, you alter the present. See, it's as simple as that. The kind of person you want to be in 15 years, you be working on that right now. Because the kind of person you're working on right now is indeed the kind of person you're going to be. There is no magic wand to just change everything. It just doesn't work like that. So when you think of the kind of strengths you'd like to have in your life in 15 years, the time to begin to work on those is right now. See, it's not how long you live that counts. It's how well. That is always the issue. And none of us has any guarantee how long we will live. Therefore, we absolutely must not waste right now. And as you look at the beginning of a year, you can make some choices right now about how you even want to spend this year. For instance, you've been motivated today, I think. Didn't Ann do a good job talking about evangelism? She made me want to go out and share my faith. I was kind of encouraged. Some of you have, you know, real red blood coursing through your veins right now, pulsating about that. And you think, oh, I'd like to be involved in sharing my faith. Well, let me just make a little suggestion. If you do not think through some of the specific things she suggested, all of a sudden it's going to be November. And you're going to be sitting in one of your classes and you're going to be thinking, darn, I was going to make some plans to do evangelism this semester. And it's November and I haven't done it. See? I mean, we're just like that. So the time to think about your semester and to make your plans is right now. You know, the choices you make right now will determine what you do this year to a great extent. And that's pretty basic. Ephesians 5, 15 and 16 is a jewel of a verse. And many of you memorize it. Paul said, therefore be careful how you walk. Not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time because the days are evil. In other words, what Paul was saying, you will never get back the time. That is the only unclaimable commodity I'm aware of. If you waste time, you are wasting life. And there is no other way about it. When you waste time, you are wasting life. Now, you can waste money and you can get money back. You cannot get time back. My last year at Southwestern Seminary, when I was finishing my master's program, there was a young man who was just wrapping up his doctoral work. He was writing his dissertation. He was about 3 months from finishing that thing, and he would have graduated with his EDD when I graduated with my MDiv. And one day he was bent over his desk and had a cerebral hemorrhage and laid his head down on his desk and died. Now, that was tragic, and it shook the seminary. And I was sad about that, even though I didn't know him. But one thing that came into my mind, I was thinking, you know, I sure hope he wasn't waiting until he got his EDD to start counting, because God knew he'd never get it. So the time to count for Christ is right now, because you have no guarantee, and I have no guarantee, that we're going to have any more time. See, if I live to be a normal age, I'm about halfway home. And I have no guarantee I'm going to live to be normal age. But I mean, I'm halfway there. So if I'm going to do anything significant, I better get on with it. Because I just don't have that much time to waste. And the choices you make right now are going to determine an awful lot of what happens. Second, hand in hand with that, and this is probably as much on the long range as it is the short range, learn to begin to think about your objectives. And to plan your life according to what your objectives are. Now, most college BSUs, frankly, this would mean nothing to them if I said this. It will mean something to you. For instance, most of you have now, at least with your head, have endorsed multiplication ministry, haven't you? I mean, you have at least endorsed with your head that that's a valuable form of ministry, to multiply your life. Because you have done that, then you have to ask yourself some pretty tough questions. How will I go about doing that? And the fact of the matter is, there have been an awful lot of OU students who have sat where you're sitting tonight and who endorsed the very same thing that you've endorsed, and a lot of them haven't turned a tap since they've been gone from here, and they were just as good a kid as you are. Some of them better. And I think some of them made some key miscalculations. And I've known some of them personally. Let me suggest a few things. If you are serious about a multiplying ministry and about investing your lives in people, and see, you ought to be serious about that. I think it's God's way. That's going to determine that two or three or four things need to happen. First of all, as you think about what you're going to do when you leave OU, whenever that, how many seniors do we have here? You're going to be seniors? And are you, I assume you're graduating, God willing. Well, your senior year is going to blow right by. It is going to just go smoking by. If you want to have a multiplying ministry, a couple of things are going to have to be true. First of all, you're going to have to be someplace where there are people. Now, that should be self-evident. But, you know, it's not. I have known people who've left this BSU and God has poured all of His Spirit into their lives and excellent training, and they get to the end of their BSU career and they want, oh, I want to have a multiplying ministry. So what do? They move to a cattle ranch in Wyoming with 14 people in 10, you know, in 100 acres around them. Now, I am not against Wyoming or cattle ranches. But the fact of the matter is, if you're going to affect people with your life, you've got to go where people are. And as you begin to plan your career, if you're really serious about this thing and making disciples, you've got to ask yourself, where are people? See? I think that's just smart. You see, when God gave us a head, He gave us a lot of leading. I don't have to pull up to a red light and pray, oh dear God, is it Your will for me to stop? And when I start thinking about having a multiplying ministry, one thing I've got to have is people. So as you think about investing your life, you got to invest it in some people for a very good reason. Discipleship ministries usually grow out of fishing ponds, and you got to ask yourself, is there going to be a fishing pond around? Is there going to be a group of people out of which I can find some faithful people to work with? And if there's not going to be a group of people, where are you going to find your people to disciple? For instance, cities are great places. College campuses are great places. Overseas, I mean, just any place, great places. Now, that's not to dismiss the small towns and say those people are insignificant. I grew up in a small town. But it is to say that if your objective is to influence a lot of people, you got to ask. For instance, if you're going to move, one of the problems with small towns, little bitty towns out of the beaten path, is that often the people who built those towns built them to get away from people. So they built them off the beaten path. So it makes sense that if you want to get in people, you don't go to a town that's been built to get away from people. Is that? Am I going too fast? I mean, that just makes good practical sense. And when you go to a little bitty town someplace where all they want out of life is what their parents wanted, was to build a little frame house and go to the football games on Friday evening, and you try to build in a vision for world discipleship, you've got a real problem on your hands. And yet, year after year, I see OU students doing that. Who stand up and, you know, tears in their eyes saying, oh, I just want God to use me in a worldwide way. Then they'll move someplace where God would have to do a major miracle to use them. That's not that God can't do it. Now, I realize that needs to be balanced. And I, as I said, I grew up in a small town. I'm not against little towns. I'm simply saying there are a lot of people who can minister in little towns. There aren't a lot of people who can make disciples. Paul, you know, do you know how big Ephesus was? You know how big Corinth was and Philippi? Those big towns. Why? There were a lot of people there. Paul went there. Another reason you need a lot of people around. Or another reason you need to watch where you're going, I guess would be a better way to say it. You're going to need more help than you've received in 4 years. I mean, you may be the shining star of the BSU, but I guarantee you're not a disciple maker yet. Because you've not had time to prove it. I probably knew as much about making disciples when I left here as just about anybody that ever lived that left here. Because, man, I had 2 solid years. my last 2 years. In fact, I stayed around one extra year, and I bet I invested 30 to 40 hours a week my last year here with Wainwright doing nothing but evangelism and Bible studies and vision training. And if anybody knew that stuff, I knew it. It took me about 7 or 8 years out of college, though, before I began to figure out what in the world I was doing. It just takes time to learn. And one of the advantages, or one of the things you need while you're learning, is people who can help you and you can be, you know, encouraged by. And if you move off to Bangor, Maine, and there's nothing in Bangor, Maine for anybody to encourage you, you won't make it. Your vision will perish. You know, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion, but woe to the one who falls when he's by himself. So if you're thinking about being a disciple maker, you need to ask yourself, where can I go that I can get some encouragement? For instance, is there going to be a church around anywhere, or a group, a fellowship or anywhere that can encourage you and keep you fired up? Because it's just real hard to keep a vision by yourself. It really is. Max was telling me just a second ago, gave me a beautiful illustration. He said he was talking to an OU student from here, and the guy said, well, and Max was saying, well, where do you really want to go? And he said, well, I really want to go to Los Angeles. And he said, well, where are your job offers? And he said, well, I've only got one job offer, and it's someplace else. And Max said, well, turn it down. If you want to go to Los Angeles, if that's your objective, then turn the other one down. See? Yeah, there are a lot of jobs around. We don't have to jump at the first thing. Let's follow where we think we're going. And a church is very significant, you know. A good church is extremely significant. And if you want to be a disciple maker, you got to ask yourself, I got to tie in with a church. Dave Dawson, some of you have heard speak. Dawson still, to this day, probably has had the most numerically effective navigator ministry on the face of the earth, I would imagine, in Singapore. I mean, just in terms of sheer converts and numbers, Dawson has had the top numerical ministry. I heard him say 2 weeks ago in a conference he and I were both in, he said the local church tends to be the issue because you have to find a place to plant your life, and the place is the local church. So you have to ask yourself, is there a church I can tie into? Another thing you have to ask yourself about, you know, your objectives, will there be somebody who can hold you accountable? Nell and I were just talking about that. One of the real problems is, who can hold me accountable for this stuff? Everybody needs to be accountable to somebody. When I went on the staff of my first church in Dell City, of course I was still close to BSU, which was a blessing. Hi, Lynn. Debbie, how are y'all? These are old, y'all forgive us, these are some dear friends that I just saw. But I was close here, and I had been on the staff of that church about a year, convinced that I had all the answers to the world's problems. And Wainwright, my old discipler, called me one day and said, Mike, let's have lunch. Ah, great. A little fellowship, you know, it's going to be great, and we're going to talk about the Lord and go over our verses. It's really going to be good. We went up and sat down up here at King's Food Host. Is that still up here on Lindsay? It's gone with the wind, is it? Well, that's an old tradition. Well, we sat down there, and we were just having a great time, and everything was going so great, and we were just sharing about the Lord. And all of a sudden, he reaches in his pocket and pulls out a little list. He said, Mike, these are some things I've heard about you, and let me ask you which ones are true. And he starts reading them. Number one, I hear you're lazy. You don't like to work. Well, now that'll bless you. Number two, I hear you think you're a little more spiritual than everybody else at your church. Seven things on that list. Now, not all of them were true, but some of them were. And I'll tell you what, I was, you know, man, as I told these guys last night, I was low enough to sit on a gum wrapper and swing my feet. But I profited from that because I was accountable to him and he was watching for my soul. See? And you need somebody. John Harrington and I sat at lunch today. I don't think Harrington mind me sharing this. You know what we talked about? Morals. Because he and I are dear friends, and we sat and questioned each other on our morals. You playing it straight, John? Yeah. Are you? Yeah. We call each other from all over the country. Say, John, are you witnessing anybody, or have you quit? You still reading your Bible? We've done that for years. See, we need somebody to hold us accountable, and if you don't put yourself in a position where you can be held accountable, you probably won't make it. You're going to wake up one day and you're going to be Polly Pewsitter thinking, whatever happened to all my plans of being a multiplier? See, accountability is very significant. One of the problems many pastors have is they're not accountable to anybody. I mean, they're like a chairman of the board, and they're totally unaccountable. And that's very significant. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? It matters where you are if you want to make disciples. It really does. A lot of people ask me when we went to San Francisco, Gad, why are you going out there? Only thing in San Francisco is earthquakes and homosexuals. Well, I'll tell you why. That place fit my objectives to a T. The chance to teach on the on a campus of a theological seminary, Southern Baptist ministers, and have a chance to radically affect their lives when they're going to be going out leading laymen, that fit my objectives to a T. See, I make decisions now according to what my objectives are. When somebody calls me and asks me to take a speaking engagement, I get a lot of invitations. There's not very many of us out there, so, you know, if you're out there, they ask you. And I take them according to my objectives. Does that fit into what I'm trying to do? I got an invitation in May to go down to San Luis Obispo, which is a beautiful campus, Cal Poly, and lead an evangelism retreat for a bunch of college students. And I knew that, because I've done those things before, and I thought, nah, they'll all come up and tell me how great it was, and then they'll go back to their camps and won't do a darn thing. Because I've led enough of those to know that's basically what happens. People don't learn to witness by going to seminars, usually. So I told the guy, I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll take it on one condition. I just did a Master Life session with 7 seminary students. If you'll let me bring them with me and let them get personal time with your students and teach them how to give their testimonies, I'll come. I said, otherwise I'm not interested. He said, okay, bring them. And I got 5 of the 7 who were willing to go the week before finals. So we drove 600 miles, and I took them in, and it worked right into my objectives. First of all, you know, I got a chance to spend personal time with my students, which is extremely important. You know, and we prayed together, and they picked my brain all the way down, all the way back. Secondly, they got a chance to be involved in teaching what I'd taught them. And that's extremely important, to give somebody a chance to pass on what you taught them. See, that fit the objectives. Most people can't make decisions like that because they don't know what their objectives are. So decide, that's what, you know, that's one of my favorite questions to seminary students is, what is your objective? You know, in as much as roundabout, therefore, blah, and they don't know where they're going. And the definition of a fanatic is somebody who, having lost sight of his objective, redoubles his efforts. And we've got people all over the country doing that. They're going faster and faster nowhere. Now, kids, you know better. Darn it. You know better than that. But that is no guarantee you will do better unless you plan to do better. So right now, if I was sitting in your place and I was a senior or a junior, I'd be praying like crazy. God, give me a viewpoint here on where I could go to carry through this vision that I've got. You know, what is needed for me to carry through the vision that I have? Some more training? Good possibility. A lot of people? More than likely. Where's a good solid church? Is there one around? That's certainly a help. That's where all the Christians are, is in the churches. I mean, ask yourself those kind of questions and make your decision on the basis of your objectives. And then if God ever leads you to a cattle ranch in Wyoming, well, thank God, He can do that. But, you know, let's make sure that we're using a little wisdom there. Another one. How can you make your life count for Christ? Understand that service is still the call. We have been called to serve. The antithesis of service is power. And it seems to me that there are only two options. You can either pursue a life where you want to be in charge, or you can pursue a life where you want to serve. Tuesday night, I had dinner with 3 other guys. One of them is a regional director for InterVarsity. One of them is a very up-and-coming young businessman who is making money hand over fist, and if all things continue as they are, he will be very wealthy in years to come. One of them is an up-and-coming young politician who may be the governor of somebody's state someday. So these were high-powered guys sitting around this table. You know, I kind of felt like a water pistol in amongst howitzers, you know. But we got on this topic of service and love because all 4 of us are in positions of power or authority. And we started talking about how subtle it is to begin to like that. Oh, I like being over people. I like having people nod in reverence when I walk in. I like having people scurrying around doing stuff for me. I mean, that is a subtle trap, and it is godless. Jesus said in Matthew 20:27 and 28, whoever would be chief among you must be your servant. even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. See, Jesus never told his disciples it was wrong to be great. He just said, I want you to be great the way that real greatness works out, and that's in service. And service is the issue. I'll use Max. I don't think I'll embarrass him. Max, I don't think I ever told you this, but when I first started hanging around with you early in years, we went a couple speaking engagements together. And he was speaking. They didn't invite me. And two or three times we got to an engagement and the chairs wouldn't be set up or something. And they would say, okay, we need some help setting these chairs up. And the first person who would stand up and start setting chairs up was Max. And I used to stand there and watch that, and I'd think to myself, huh, he really believes this stuff, that he's really no big cheese just because he's the speaker. And as the years came and I started getting speaking engagements, I started going and the very same thing happened. And I discovered a real truth. When you're the speaker, you don't have to set the chairs up. You can take your Bible and go over and sit down in the corner and people think you're preparing your message. In other words, you can assume a posture of authority. I am the speaker. Y'all set the chairs up. But Paul said in 2 Corinthians 4:5, his ministry was two things. He said, for what we preach is Jesus Christ is Lord and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. Two things. Now, I've heard a lot of people preach Christ is Lord. I've not heard too many people preach ourselves as your servants. And I'll tell you what, I started following that lead that he set for me. I have done it ever since. Deliberately going out of my way to serve. And, you know, it just freaks some people out. They have a runaway right there. I spoke at a banquet about 2 weeks, or 2 months ago, and I showed up in my little three-piece, you know, vested suit and looked like I crawled off a wedding cake. And after it was all over and they were picking stuff up and carrying it in the kitchen and I started picking stuff up, and the hostess just, she just couldn't stand that. Oh, no, you're the guest speaker. You can't do that. What she was telling me is I've never seen too many guest speakers do that. But see, our posture is to be one of service. And boy, the best way to keep pride from setting in is to serve. To take a staunch posture of service. Now, authority and responsibility and leadership just come. But boy, if they come and they're of God, that's fine. I mean, they're going to have to be some leaders. But the way to gain leadership is through service. And then if God chooses to elevate you, that's his business. But your job is to serve. If you want your life to count, you make your life a posture of service, not a life of going for power and authority. To begin with, having power and authority doesn't make you happy. Being a servant does. There's another thing that goes hand in hand with that one. And really, it's so close, we probably shouldn't have divided them. And that is love is the really ultimate in ministering to people. When everything else is said and done, it doesn't really matter so much what we know as it does whether or not we love the people we're ministering to. I was talking to a pastor about 3 months ago. He called me and asked me to consider a position on his church staff. And during the course of the conversation, he mentioned another staff member on his church that we both knew. And I said, well, how's so-and-so doing? He said, well, he's not doing too well. And I said, why? He said, well, I don't think he loves the people. And I think they know it. You know, I don't think he loves them. And I think they know it. Let me tell you a couple stories about Bailey Smith. You know who Bailey is? He's pastor First Southern in Del City. Well, now, Bailey's not a perfect guy. He and I have disagreed over the years on enough things, you know, to keep us both up late at nights and still maintain a friendship. But, you know, I learned something from Bailey Smith when I was working with him. He really pretty much convinced me that he loved people. I don't know what he's like now. I haven't worked with him 8 or 10 years, but, you know. Because I saw him do some strange things that you don't have to do when you're the pastor of a big church. I can remember several times after Sunday evening services, he would have already preached 3 times that day, be dead tired, counseled, had meetings all afternoon long, and everybody, the church would be over at night, and all the church members would flee and would go to Denny's and drink coffee and stuff. And I'd usually have a meeting or something. And several times I'd come back in from one of those meetings, and it'd be 9:30 in the sanctuary, it'd be dark, and the custodians would be sweeping up. And old Bailey would be sitting on the front row of the church with some church member, an insignificant one, if you understand what I mean by that. Not the chairman of the deacons, not somebody that we have to protect because they give a lot of money. Somebody that really, frankly, in the eyes of most people, wouldn't matter. And I'd see Bailey sitting there talking to them late at night because he was their pastor and they asked to talk to him. And I'll tell you what, there was a time when I was there when those people would have followed him in an assault on hell with a water gun because he had convinced them he loved them. And see, that's worth a lot as a leader. You remember King David? The episode in his life that 2 Samuel, I think it's 24 relates or 23 relates. Boy, this just fires me up to learn leadership. Would you like to be a leader? There is a real key to this thing. Let me give you a little clue to leadership. People will not follow you unless they want to. I mean, you can stand up there and quote them verses about submitting, and you can do everything you want to do, but the bottom line is, if they don't want to follow, they won't. For instance, my wife. Now, we've been married 11 years. And I can just take all kinds of verses and just quote them to her all day long about what she's supposed to do, how she's supposed to, you know, kind of step in line there and everything, depending on how you interpret those. I found out real early that if she doesn't want to follow me, she won't. She's not a bit impressed with the verses. And I can't pull her or push her or beat her. My only hope is to lead her. And if she doesn't want to follow, nothing I can do about it. So I have to figure out how to get her to follow. And guys, now this is just for you. Girls, stop listening. Guys, the only way to get a woman to follow you is to love them. Did you ever see Camelot? Love her. Simply love her. It's good. Well, back to the story. King David, about 2 Samuel 23 or 24, ran into the story tells that one day he was sitting up in the hills in a fortress overlooking Bethlehem, and the whole Philistine garrison was occupying Bethlehem. Now, that was his boyhood home, and this happened all the time. David and the Philistines were always chasing each other across Palestine. It was really exciting, you know. They didn't have anything to do that weekend, so they'd go fight the Philistines. It's back and forth. But the story is told that David is sitting there, and apparently he's kind of daydreaming. He's kind of thinking out loud to himself, and he says, and of course that well in Bethlehem was the well he probably drank from when he was a boy. And he's kind of daydreaming, and he says, boy, I wish I had a drink from that well. And the Bible says three of his mighty men, his chief soldiers, strapped on their swords, climbed down the hill, cut their way through that Philistine garrison, went over, got him a pitcher of water, cut their way back through, climbed their way back up the mountain and handed it to him and said, here. Now that is leadership. And I asked myself, why would they do that for him? What did he do to get those guys to love him like that? Well, I think there's a clue. Turn in your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 22. I just stumbled into this one morning in my quiet time. That's why it's good to keep having one. You're liable to be blessed. First Samuel chapter 22. Two relatively little insignificant looking verses, but I think there's a key here. You found it? 1 Samuel 22, verses 1 and 2. Listen to this. Now, this is when David has already been anointed king, and he's on the run from King Saul, who is already king. It says, so David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's household heard of it, they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, everyone who was discontented gathered to him. I mean, that's really an Ivy League crew, isn't it? And he became captain over them. Now there were about 400 men with him. In other words, the cast-offs of the society gathered to David. The malcontents, the debtors, those that were in trouble, gathered to him, and he became their captain. Now think about that for just a second. If you were a cast-off of society, and somebody of some significance said they believed in you and you could follow them around, how would that make you feel? I imagine one day if he wanted a drink of water, it would make you feel like you wanted to strap on your sword and go cut your way through a garrison and get some for him. Because he believed in me. You know, nobody else did. He thought I was significant. See, now that is leadership. And you can't fake people out like that. You either think they're significant or you don't. You either use them or you help them. One of the two. Carolyn, are you here? Okay, well, good. I've shared this about her two or three other times, but it always embarrasses her, so it's good, probably good she's not here. About my junior year here at OU, I was saving it into my freshman year, and boy, about my junior year, things had not started straightening out yet. And I, you know, I had been voted most likely not to succeed in the Christian life, and frankly, with good reason. And a lot of the students around kind of gave me that idea. Now, the staff was pretty kind, but a lot of the students who were kind of in on things, kind of in crowd, they kind of treated me like I was, he's not one of us, you know. He plays the piano and everything, but he's never going to make it. He chases women, and he's obnoxious, and he's loud. He's probably never going to make it. And that's kind of the attitude I got from the in crowd. You know, well, he's not, you know, he doesn't memorize scripture yet. He's not one of us. And, you know, after a while, if people begin to see you like that, you begin to see yourself like that. If everybody treats you like a problem, you begin to think you are one. And it was about that time that Carolyn Teague stepped into my life for the first time. And, of course, I didn't know what she was doing then. I just thought she was a discerning woman. I didn't know. But she began to pull me off to the side. And she'd pull me in her little office in there. That's when she had that little cubby hole back in there. And she'd pull me in there and she'd say, "Mike, you know what? I really noticed some good qualities about you. You know, you stand up straight when you walk and stuff like that." I mean, you know, she was really looking hard for him. I mean, you know, your teeth are white, Mike. She had to be creative to find him, is what I'm saying. But see, I admired her because she was a woman of God. And she'd say that stuff to me and I'd turn and walk out of that office and I'd think, well, I'll be. A leader thinks I've got something going for me. And I began to think, I may make it. See? And I have done that over the years for people. Tried to point out for them what I thought were assets in their lives. Because people need to know they've got them. And we're going to talk about that a little later tonight, by the way. But people follow if you love them. So if you want to be a leader, you figure out how to communicate to people that you love them. And you'll probably do pretty good at getting them to follow. Another thing we might add along the lines of love, loving people will cause you to be patient with them. Do you know how patient God is with you? The fact that you are still here is a testimony that God is patient. If I was running things, none of you would have made it. And if you were running things, I wouldn't have made it. Because if God demanded of me what I demand of people, none of us would have made it. I mean, I expect people to be perfect. If they blow it, I expect them. I give them one chance to straighten it up, then I'm ready to boot them out of the church. And see, loving people begins to cause us to grow to be patient. And well, if you want to minister and have a disciple-making ministry, you're going to have to learn to be patient with people. Sometimes I get so hacked off at students I'm working with, seminary students, and I'll think, you jerk or jerkette, whatever it is, why do you not see that? I mean, I have told you, and then I'll think, well, now, Mike, you've been at this 15 years. Why do you expect them to see in 6 months where it's taken you 15 years to see? And it causes us to be patient. Now, I have used this illustration before. I've used it all over the country. It's one of my favorite, but boy, it helps me to understand this thing. See, the Christian life is a long, slow pilgrimage. And God is very patient. How many of you have just absolutely wiped out in something the last year or two? Well, the rest of you need to confess lying. Because you probably have wiped out in something. You just don't remember. Well, you know, God is able to forgive that stuff and be patient and press on. This little illustration, you know, that I've used. I have two exceptional children. You know, they really are. And you know how we taught them to walk? Let me tell you. This is how it was. Mary Beth, when she was about 6 months, and I thought, well, it's time for her to walk. So I began to hang. Now, quit laughing. This is a serious illustration. So I began to hang posters in her crib of people walking. And I'd get a pointer and I'd say, now, honey, look at this knee here. This is, look at these sinews and how the tendons work together. Now, put that rattle down. Look over here, Mary Beth. I'm talking to you. Now, see the legs and how they move together. See, that's... Now, is that how we taught her to walk? No. No, one day she was sitting on her little bottom, padded as it was, in the middle of the floor, and grabbed a hold of something and stood up and took a step and just collapsed. She had seen other people do that. And so she tried it and she took a step and just... Sometime later, she stood back up again and took another little step and collapsed. And but she kept doing it. And she'd pull herself up and she'd walk and she'd fall and she'd fall and she'd walk and walk and fall. That's back and forth again and again and again and again. Until finally, she reached the point where she could walk more than she could fall. And she had established the pattern of walking. Now, does that mean she still can't fall? Nah, she can still fall. She can do a 1.5 right now, right in the middle of the carpet. Just... But see, her pattern is no longer falling. Her pattern is now walking. And the Christian life is very similar to that. When we first get saved or when we first start to grow, we begin to walk and we'll drop over dead in our tracks, you know, and we'll humiliate the kingdom and ourselves and the BSU, and we'll crawl back up and God will dust us off and we'll take off again, make new commitments. God, I'm never going to sin again. I'm never missing my... It's you and me, you know, we'll make it about 2 days and just fall totally apart. And we'll get back up and go and fall and go and until finally, all things being as they should, we begin to walk more than we fall. And that's called maturity. Now, does that mean we can't fall? Shoot, no, we can still fall. But our pattern now is not falling. Our pattern is walking. And that's why the Bible commands us to walk with God. It gives us a picture of a good, steady pilgrimage. And God is very patient with us. And we'll just collapse in a heap, and He'll pick us up and dust us off and say, well, you know, you're not much, but you're all I've got. Let's try it again. See, and He is very patient. And when we begin to love people, we begin to learn to be patient with them. And see, you can never tell who's going to make it. Max, you remember Rusty Barksdale? Boy, if there was ever a student at the BSU at OU that was more unlikely than me to be significant, it had to be Barksdale. Gad, he was a problem. He was a pain. Nobody around here thought Barksdale was going to be worth a rip. Now, half the girls thought God was trying to build him into their lives, but, you know, nobody thought Barksdale was going to be worth anything. And he'd never given anybody any indication he had. He was, you know, he was my roommate. And he was a dear friend and all that, but, you know, he didn't have much more going for him than I did for me. Well, he finally graduated from this place. Wow, what a relief. Barksdale is gone. Went down to Houston where nobody knew him. Nobody knew his reputation and got a chance to start over. And I began to hear things from Houston. I began to hear that Barksdale was leading out in First Baptist Church Houston in evangelism and discipleship. And I thought, not my Barksdale. Barksdale is now singles minister at First Baptist Church Jackson, Mississippi. One of the largest churches in our denomination, and I understand he's doing a good job. See, you never know who's going to make it and who's not. And some of the people we think are going to be the real chargers, we've never seen them yet. I mean, they're still out there tooling around. And some of those we thought, oh, what a problem. Would you have picked Peter? Now ask yourself that question. Peter only opened his mouth to change feet. Would you have picked him? How about Thomas? Or James and John? Well, what a bunch of winners. I've heard Leroy Imes say, and I think it's true, when Jesus gave the Great Commission, he said, go ye therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptize them, and so on and so on. He said, I think the reason Jesus left so quick, he just didn't want to hear the conversation that was getting ready to take place. And I just imagine Peter, don't worry about me, Lord. You can count on me. I'll never fail you. See? Well, Jesus had heard that before someplace. James and John, well, I'll tell you what, if they don't want to be disciples, we'll just burn hell out of them, you know. That's what we'll just call down fire right from heaven. We'll get them. And there's Thomas. I just don't know if we can do it. I don't know if we can do it. I mean, what a group to start a world enterprise with. But see, God doesn't choose anybody, now get this, for what they are. He chooses them for what they will become by His grace. And that's how you got in. All of us got in, not because of who we are, but because of what we could become. A student went running up to Howard Hendricks one day and said, "Oh, Dr. Hendricks, I got a terrible problem." He said, "Really, what is it?" He said, "Why did Jesus choose Judas?" And Hendricks said, "Oh, that's no problem." He said, "I know why he chose Judas." He said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, I got a bigger problem than that." He said, "What is it?" He said, "Why did he choose you?" "And I got even a bigger problem than that. Why did he choose me?" Well, see, Jesus chose us not because of who we are, but because of who we would become in him. And therefore, a loving leader is patient with people and sees their potential. And if you want to make your life count for Christ, you'll have to learn to love people. Be patient with them. Well, there's several more things, but I've only got time for one more. Let me share one with you that hits close to home. I've never shared this with a group, but since I love you all more than I love any other group, I wouldn't have taken this speaking engagement if it had been anything but OU. My wife told me roundly I had no business taking it. But I said, "Well, it's OU." And she said, "I know it." And you still had no business taking it. And she was right. But I took it. And since it's you, I'll share with you a little illustration I've never shared with anybody else. One of the ways your life will count for Christ is if you continue to establish a posture for learning lifelong. If you never get to the point where you quit learning or where you get beyond the point of obedience, if you ever stiffen your neck and say, "Beyond this I will not go, beyond that you will not go." You know, it's as simple as that. And the problem is that some of that's very painful. You know, I shared that illustration with you about Wainwright, that learning. That was not much fun. But I suppose the most painful thing that's happened to me happened about 2.5 years ago. We'd had a lot of things happen. My father had been killed in an accident. My folks had divorced and all that. It had been a rough time and all kinds of stuff had happened. And we had just been contacted by Golden Gate to go out there. And there comes a time when you just suck it up and go, whether you feel like it or not. My high school football coach, you could be laying there in the middle of the blood and the mud and everything else, and he'd walk by and say, "Can you spit?" And if you could spit, he'd say, "Get up, you can go." You know, so there comes a time in a conference like this when your sitter has been sat on about all that it wants to be, and you don't think I can take in any more, and that's probably true. So what you do is you just suck it up and go on. It's really good practice for ministry. I used to hear these guys that I admired so much in ministry talk about how tired they could get. And in fact, Max used to say, "You know, you guys are always praying for God to use you and everything." He said, "You get qualified, God will wear you out." He said, that's not the problem. You know, the problem is not that God didn't want to use you. Well, I don't know how qualified I am, but I began to experience that the last few years. I mean, every time I turn around, there are 800 people standing right there that want to get some personal time. And I mean, it can just literally wear you out. But it's kind of a nice way to be worn out. So, let's suck it up and keep going, shall we? This is a commitment time. Commitment, really, is a very simple word. What it basically means is a promise. We make a promise, we're going to do something. And life's full of promises. You promise that you're going to go to school and make your grades so the University of Oklahoma lets you in. I mean, you make a promise to them that you're going to do that because they're spending tax money, you know, helping put you through school. You make a promise to your employer that when he or she hires you, you're going to show up on time and do your job. What you've basically done is promise them you're going to be faithful. Now, you may not be, but if you didn't, you broke a promise. Now, you're going to stand before a preacher someday, God willing, and have some little filly or, you know, something right beside you. Or if you happen to be a girl, hopefully you'll have a guy. San Francisco, we're never exactly sure, you know, what you have. And you're going to make a promise. And you're going to say that you're going to love that person when you don't feel like loving them. And you're going to be faithful to them when you don't feel like being faithful. And you're going to work on your relationship when you don't feel like working on it. Because you're promising. And tonight we're going to talk about commitment as far as you go and as far as this BSU goes. Two or three different areas we want to talk about. First of all, I want to remind you that when you make a commitment, you always need to be reminded of what the writer of Ecclesiastes said when he was talking about vows. He said it really is better not to make one of those things if you're going to break it. It really would be bitter. He said, God would just assume that you not vow at all than that you vow and break it. Now, there might come times in all of our lives when we make vows and we have to break them for circumstances beyond our control. But if we make a vow and we just break it because we just decide we don't want to pay the price, that's a different ball game. So there's a certain extent to which the vow you're making, the commitment you're making being on the BSU leadership team is a vow to God. And that is fairly significant. You know? Secondly, you're making a vow to one another. You're making a promise and a commitment to one another, and we're going to be talking about that in just a second. And you really are making that kind of a commitment. And thirdly, and that commitment, by the way, is joining together with one another on working on an objective. So you're supposed to be going someplace with this leadership team. We're not just all gathering together and roaring off in 100 directions. We're here trying to go someplace. So you're vowing to work with everybody else to reach the objective. And thirdly, strangely enough, you're really making a vow to yourself. You say, I want to be a person of enough integrity that I can look myself in the mirror and say, hey, I do what I said I'd do. I said I'd do that, and I'm going to do it. It's done an awful lot for my self-image over the years, being a fairly faithful person. You know what? It really has. It's a strange thing when you begin to grow and when you... I really kind of like me. I know that sounds strange, but there were a lot of years I didn't. You know? And I really kind of enjoy being with me now. Because of the person that God has made, I enjoy some of the character qualities that I have. And I'm pretty faithful. That's something God built into my life, and I enjoy it. That makes me feel very good about myself. I can be dependent upon. If I tell somebody I'll do something, I'll do it. And that gives me a very strong self-image. I look myself in the mirror, and I like the person I see. And all of that's wrapped up in commitment and vows. And we want to talk about that a little bit. Okay? First of all, you need to understand that, you know, when you make your commitments this year, that you're basically saying to God and to one another and to the staff of the BSU, you're basically saying that if you're going to be on the leadership team, that you are committing yourself to do what you're asked to do. And it's just really good to understand that up front. You're committing yourself to make the meetings that you're asked to make. And I think I know this place well enough to know that they won't be having any meetings that are a waste of time. I used to tell my Sunday school leadership that, and Ella White can appreciate that. I used to say, I hate meetings. I hate them with a passion. God knows I hate them. But I'll promise you that if it is in my power, I will not have a meeting that will waste your time. Now, I had to break that a few times, but it wasn't in my power. So you're committing yourself to make the meeting. Second thing you're committing yourself to, you're committing yourself to live a life that is consistent with the objective you're trying to carry out. And that's really pretty heavy. You know, you're committing yourself to be consistent with what you say you're trying to do. And you're committing yourself to be responsible to one another to do that. Now, what that means is you're committing yourself to be accountable to one another. And that means somebody will have the right to say to you, if you're not being faithful, they'll have the right to call you on the carpet for it. That's what a commitment means. If you say you'll do that and you're not doing it, then somebody will have the right to say to you, now, there seems to be a problem here. What's the problem? Now, do we all understand that? See, that's what a commitment's about. Somebody would have the right to say, hey, now, you've missed two team meetings in a row. Is there a problem? And if there's a problem, fine. If there's not a problem, then what about the commitment? And are you committing yourself to love the people in this room? And that's all, you know, that's very significant. So just for a second, why don't you put down your pen and pencil and let's just think. From what you've heard for the past day and a half and from what you know is going to be expected just between you and God, now you don't have to bow your head or anything, look overtly religious, but is there any reason before God that you couldn't say, Lord, I'm really ready to commit myself to this? Because if there is, now is the time to think about that. So you just have to ask yourself that question, you know, is there any reason why I cannot do that, God? Because we're going to ask you to promise him that you are. And I don't want to ask you to commit blasphemy and lie. Secondly, and this one's even tougher, God, is there anybody in this room that I cannot commit myself to love? Is there anybody in this room right now that I just flat resent? And if they try to hold me accountable, I might punch them out in the name of the Lord. Because that just might be the person that walks up to hold you accountable for your commitment. And you give them a good shout in Jesus' name. You know, that wouldn't. So you have to ask yourself, is there anybody in this room? And if there is, this might be the time to, in just a second, to go take care of that. And say, hey, I have resented your being under this roof all day. And before we hook hands and hearts, I need to settle that. I mean, you're not promising that you're going to be their best friend, but you are saying, I have resented you all day, and I just need to make that right. So you get them in your mind right now.